Welcome, aviators. It's a pleasure to have you again here on the Aviator's Guide. I'm Holly Bellino, and today with me I have a DPE, which is a designated pilot examiner, and his name is Adam Levine. Thank you for being here today, Adam.
Holly, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join you on your podcast.
I'm so happy that you can do this with me today. Sure. As you know, I had previously had an AME, so it's good to get all the different facets of aviation on the show for the newer pilots out there, or even the ones who've been in for a while. So just today only, I'm taking a short break from my new mini series that I have out on ways that you can build flight hours. So I will be going back into that after this episode today. First off, how did you get started into aviation?
Truth in advertising, right? Holly sent me like the list of questions, so I had some time to ponder this. But grew up in an aviation family.
You were a third generation pilot?
I was.
That's amazing.
My dad and my granddad were both Marine fighter pilots. As long as I can remember seeing like their old flying helmets or their deployment books, pictures of my granddad flying in the Pacific in World War II or in Korea, and then pictures of my dad flying in Vietnam, I was like, wow, that's really cool. It was never really a general aviation thing. It was always, I really want to be a fighter pilot when I grow up. So that was kind of there. In college, there were several programs where you could join the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps. I remember very vividly being a freshman in college and walking through the student union at George Washington. It was a career week, so they had all these recruiting tables out there for different companies. I remember seeing Captain French. He was a recruiter, and there was a big poster of an F-18 behind him. And I just kind of beelined over the table.
Like, that's it. That's what I want.
And he's like, oh, we got a sucker today. No. So they had this program where you were guaranteed an aviation contract if you met the testing requirement, the air medical requirement. And what it meant was you will join the Marine Corps and they'll guarantee you a spot in flight training. It didn't mean you'd be a pilot. They just said, we're going to guarantee you a spot in flight training.
The free training alone is
You think about, so you have to like bifurcate that, right? You think in terms of general aviation, it's like, oh my God, it's going to cost me $130,000 to become a CFI. Like, none of that's a factor when you're, think of it in the context of serving your country, right? The higher order, you know, joining the Marine Corps and then becoming a pilot. So the cost doesn't come to mind. It's that end state of, oh my gosh, if I get through this, they're actually going to give me the keys to an F-18 potentially one day. And like I said, there's no guarantee you'll be a pilot or what you're going to fly. But essentially, you know, you go through the training. It was officer candidate school, which had nothing to do with flying. It had everything to do with just surviving that experience. And then you go to kind of an infantry course for 6 months where all new lieutenants go. And then after you've been in for like a year, you finally go to the Mecca of Naval Aviation, which is Pensacola, Florida. And then you wait and you wait. You do this thing called aviation pre-flight indoctrination, which is, imagine like all the ground training instruction, you know, you would receive in the context of a professional flight school, either 61 or 141, they jam it into about 3 weeks.
Wow.
You haven't even touched an airplane yet, but it's a lot of aero theory, weather, navigation. It's nothing more than really in that context an intellectual exercise to cram as much information in and then test you on everything in very detailed minutia to wash people out, essentially. And then you do a lot of survival training there. You know, there's a lot of time in the pool with all this equipment on. But anyway, at the end of that process, then you finally go to your primary flight training. And I went through in 99 or 2000. Yeah, 99. The airplane they were flying back then was called the T-34C. And we'll hit pause here for a second, because part of that program that the Marine Corps had when you were going to go for an aviation contract was it would actually pay a local flight school to provide you instruction. And I would not say it was up to a pilot certificate. It was to get a sense of, you may have this idea that you want to fly. Let's not spend hundreds of thousands of dollars
on
the T-34. Yeah. So I went to a small flight school outside of Washington, D.C. I think it was like Hyde Park, and then flew an Cessna 152 for about 8 or 9 hours and up to solo. And that's what they did. It's a solo or 10 hours, whichever came first. I remember my recruiting officer was like, so what do you think? I'm like, that was awesome. So then kind of fast forward about a year and a half later in flight training, and the first airplane you fly is a T-34C, which has now been mostly retired from pilot training, but it's a turboprop. So complex, high performance in the context of FAA terms. PT-6 engine, so very common kind of power plant, I think, that you still find in multiple variations of turboprop aircraft. And high performance, so I mean, -2 or -3 to +6 G. So I mean, this fully aerobatic aircraft.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And totally overpowered for what it was doing. But the kind of similarity with general aviation is like you have a primary instructor, and that person will take you up through your first solo, and then you kind of parse out from there. And I had this guy named Jeff Tawil, who was super cool, old, crusty Marine major, had thousands of hours of flying experience, and he was like the benevolent dictator, you know? but we had such a great time together. I learned so much from him. And then I remember like getting up to that pre-solo check. It's like the first time you go with someone else, not your instructor. You fly in the pattern, you navigate, you communicate, fly the aircraft, pass that, and then you move on to basic instruments, and then we moved on to navigation, and then we actually do some formation flying. So it's kind of all leading towards a context of military aviation, where the takeoff and the landing is a byproduct of the mission, right? We're going to go out there, we're going to do something, right? So then about 6 months later, you get about 70, 80, 90 hours in the airplane, depending on weather or brakes or whatnot. And then there's that selection process where you put your dream sheet on. Back then, I don't know if it's changed, you have to do better than 50% of the last 100 kids that went through in order to qualify for jet training. All my buddies, like, we always wanted to be fighter pilots. Some people wanted to fly helicopters, good on them, or transports. You get your grades right at the end of the syllabus, but then you're being compared to not just your little squadron, and we had three squadrons in our base and the two squadrons in another base. So we're talking about five kind of graduating classes every other week with five kids each. So it's quite a number.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have no idea how they did, but you know how you did relative to the last 100 people. You'll line up in front of the commander. He takes out your dream sheet. He's like, all right, hey, Adam, Jets is your number one. You broke out. You were number whatever, 2 out of 25, whatever that number was. And you're just thinking, just get over it.
Just tell me.
He's like, hey, man, congratulations. You qualify for jet training. Best of luck to you. After you just said, congratulations, Jets, I mentally shut down.
Like, you're like, that's all I wanted. I'm so excited.
From there, I went to Meridian, Mississippi. I flew an airplane called the T2C Buckeye. It's been retired for a while. It was built in like the 60s. They modified it and went from single engine to two engine. So here you are, 22, 23 years old. You got 70 hours on D-34. And then you're jumping into basically high performance subsonic fully aero aircraft, twin engine. Reflecting back on avionics, it had we call it the Abba Jabba. It was like this big attitude indicator. It had a DME drum for VOR, DME, TACAN. And it had a receiving needle on it, which is about 6 radials thick, right? So, I mean, you were plus or minus always 3, you know, when you're navigating around. There was no four flight, no GPS back then. Generally now I see kids at like 50 to 60, 70 hours going through private pilot, and then you go into instrument, right? So imagine that kind of same number of hours. Now you're flying a high subsonic aircraft, around at 300, 400 knots above the ground. First thing you do is you sit in the back for the first couple rides and you do basic instruments. Just doing 180 and 360 turns, S patterns, right? Just learning how to fly instruments. And then eventually you take the hood off, you get in the front seat, and you learn how to take off and land. And now you're going into naval aviation, right? There is no concept in that level of training where you're doing a normal landing, a soft field landing, a short field landing, or a powerful 180. Like, everything is focused on landing on the carrier. From that first sortie in the front seat, when you come back to the landing pattern, you have a carrier landing box. You have an optical landing system, right? Think about a Vazier Pappy, but on the aircraft carrier, it's much more precise.
That's good.
and then you're focusing on lineup, energy management, angle of attack, then glide slope, right? And you're on the back side of the power curve on these airplanes, so you're not pointing your nose at the ground. You are getting the aircraft dirty, all the flaps come down, and then you're using power to adjust your glide slope. You're using stick inputs to adjust angle of attack, and then obviously lineup. So slightly different construct from how we think about general aviation flying.
Right. You said that there are PAPIs on there. Or
flaws, optical landing system.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you know how like usually PAPIs at a normal runway, they're right. helping you aim for the 1,000 footers. Where are they helping you aim on the carrier?
Oh, well, on the carrier, everything is designed to spot a wire or an area in front of the wire. And really it's to grade the hook from an approach point about 3/4 mile behind the ship on a defined glide slope down to touch point.
That makes sense.
That is between generally in the old carriers or 4 cables out there. You want to land between the second and third, and I think it's about 240 or 280 feet from the aft end of the carrier to that spot. So when you're in intermediate flight training in the T2, it's all focused on getting to that point. We'd go do aerobatics, navigation, low levels, whatnot, and then you'd save enough gas to come back in the pattern and do like 10 landings. But all that said, as you get through that training, we then moved it to T-45, which is called the Goshawk, I think, built by Boeing. At any rate, now you're going from an airplane that was built in the 60s, you know, with 70s kind of avionics, to what was then in 2001, 2000, a modern glass cockpit. We had 2 digital displays, a heads-up display. We had ILS. I'm like, I have an ILS now. This jet was capable of going to 30s, 40,000 feet, you know, and then you learn how to fly the aircraft, but immediately going into tactics, right? We would do bombing. So you carry like these little blue 25-pound bombs. We go to the bombing pattern and you drop a bunch of bombs and you get graded on how well you drop them. We do low-level navigation. We had basically a sectional equivalent, flying at 500 feet and about 400 knots. You're doing these low-level routes called VR or IR routes. There are kids training out there every day and you just go fly these routes all around Mississippi, Alabama. I think we went to Georgia for a little bit. You know, you're doing your VFR flight plan or your VFR navigation. Now you're at 4,500 feet and you're flying in a 172 or even a Cirrus. And you're like, oh my God, I'm going to miss my checkpoint here in 10 minutes and 3 miles away. And here you're going at 500 feet, 420. You can't even see much more than a couple miles in front of you. It's all happening very quickly. But the whole concept behind that is to start employing the aircraft. So we do bombing, you do aerial combat, a bunch of other dynamic maneuvers in naval aviation. It's take off from the carrier, do a mission, come back to the carrier. So at the end of that training, about a year, now we got about 230 hours total. You actually trained to go to the carrier and we went to the carrier. So you go land on the carrier 10 times during the day, and that was a lot of fun. Very interesting experience because you practice this in a very confined environment on a base. There's lots of pilots. You know, the ship's on a time clock. You know, they got to get the mission done. There's a lot of pressure on there.
So what are those things that are called that capture the aircraft when you come and land on the carrier?
What you're seeing is actually called a cross-deck pendant, but people refer to it as the wire. So you want the hook, you want to touch down about 10 or 15 feet before the three wires, so you catch a three wire.
How long after one pilot lands on the wires does it take to get everything out of the way for the next pilot?
They're shooting for about 55 seconds.
Okay.
Minute, right? So, but when you're a student naval aviator, you're like, I just want to land on this thing safely. But you're flying in formation, so we're at a four ship, right? So number one is an instructor pilot, and then two, three, and four are students. So you take off, everyone joins the number one, you fly it off the coast, 60, 70 miles. Flying in formation, I don't know, have you ever flown in formation?
Yes, I did once in flight school.
Okay, mm-hmm. All right. So, I mean, this is like you're flying 20, 30 feet away from your instructor, you know, kind of close formation, and you dare to look down on occasion and, oh my gosh, there's a darn ship down there. And you're like, I can't do this. And you hold the radio chatter, and number one goes to the downwind. And then I think you count like 15 or 20 seconds. Whatever it is, it was like, it felt like way too short, but it took like way too long. And then you just drill straight ahead, and then you turn on your interval. You're about 600 feet AGL. You turn downwind, you configure the aircraft. This is all happening pretty quick. But you've practiced this hundreds of times.
Before you're landing on the carrier, right. Yeah.
But don't forget, the ship is moving all the time at 12 to 15 knots. Oh, by the way, it's an angled deck, so you're fine. Bearing where the ship is actually heading is slightly offset from where you're actually going to land, about 6-7 degrees, right? Yeah. When you get a beam to point of intent and landing, like think about like a powerful 180 concept,
right.
Like you start your turn, and it's a very deliberate, very optimum angle of attack turn to arrive about 3/4 of a mile behind the ship, I think 375 to 400 feet AGL with lineup solved. Then you are basically transitioning into that visual scan looking at the meatball, which is the optical landing system. Got a datum to show optimum glide slope, and then you've got a kind of a light pattern where if you're on the glide slope or above, it's orange.
Okay.
As you get low, what color do you think it turns into?
Red.
Red. Right, so red is dead. So it's a lot of visual landing aids. So you're working on glide slope, you're working on your angle of attack, and you're working on your lineup, right? Because the ship is always moving away from you, if that makes sense. At an angle, you're not supposed to actually look at the wires or the landing area. All you're doing is you're looking for the lineup, broadly speaking, angle of attack, and your glide slope. And you are supposed to fly that lens of the meatball all the way down to touchdown. And then we've got landing signals officer out there that are basically, one, grading you, but two, making sure that you're operating safely. So if are lined up left or right, they'll give you corrections, but they'll say you're a little high or you're a little low, and they can actually look at your angle of attack, and there's an angle of attack indexer lights in front of the aircraft that will repeat what you're seeing in the cockpit. So the landing signals officer may see a green or a red light and then say you're fast or you're slow, i.e. a reminder for you to get the right angle of attack on, because there's no one in your back seat. You're by yourself.
Okay.
And to complete of that training, you select a platform, and now you've been in naval aviation training. You've really been away from the Marine Corps for about a year or two. And then you select, and I went to Naval Air Station Lemoore and learned how to fly the F-18 for a year. And that was all tactics, right? At the very junior level, if that makes sense, like how to be a good wingman. And then at the end of that training, you are assigned a squadron. I was assigned to go down to Marine Corps Station Miramar in beautiful San Diego. But I get to my first operational unit, and at least in the Marine Corps then, it was all F-18s in Miramar for the fighters. But you had land base, single seat, two seat, and then you had the carrier base. And I'm like, I want to be in a carrier base squadron. And I joined the world famous Black Knights, VMFA 314. And like 90 days later, we're on the ship getting ready to go in deployment. I spent 10 years in the F-18 at Miramar. I did a carrier deployment and I did a forward air controller tour. So we take our pilots and we attach them to a ground infantry unit and they become like a liaison officer. And then I went back and I did a couple land-based deployments in the F-18. Then I taught in the F-18 training squadron in Miramar for a couple years. And in that time, I was fortunate to go to Top Gun and then the Marine Corps Weapons School Weapons and Tactics Instructor course.
You went to Top Gun?
I did.
That's so cool.
I can safely say that it was a very humbling experience. You're assigned a call sign early on in your training. If you like the call sign, you keep it. If you don't like it, you keep it. There is no training it back in.
So what was your call sign?
My call sign is Beavis.
Beavis?
Yeah. You get their first unit and they don't know you. They're like, hey, new guy. You know, they have like the new guy rules, which I don't think I can recite here. But it's basically join up, shut up, be humble, study as hard as you can. If you're asked a question, answer the question. If you don't know it, I'll find out the answer. And there are a bunch of tests when you join up to your first unit. And the list of publications... And it was like a stack of books like this. You know, one
fun.
Is how to fly the airplane, right? The NATOPS manual, which is like the POA, and then all the tactics manuals. And you're like, I'm never going to figure this out. You can never be in the right formation. You're always losing sight. You're not, I say, shooting the right people, but like in air-to-air combat training, there's a lot of employment of weapons simulated, of course, you know, in training. But, you know, are you shooting the right weapon? Are you shooting at the right range? Are you keeping formation? Are you doing all the things that you need to do in order to be successful. Oh, by the way, you have to employ the radar while you're flying. So imagine flying in formation at near supersonic speeds, dynamically maneuvering, looking at the radar, trying to sort the right contact, trying to shoot, trying to defend, trying to find the merge, trying to employ. And then you got to go back to the ship and land on that ship. And if you're doing it at night, it's a wholly separate experience. That can be very frightening. You know, during the day, it can be fun sometimes. At night, it is a deadly serious business.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
My goodness. Do you have any advice for anybody who wants to join the military for the aviation side?
Well, I've got a couple jokes, but, I've not made any of these up. But today, you know, writ large in the Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, like, equipment's all brand new. You know, I get to fly the F-35 as my day job, and you know, we're delivering that amazing aircraft to the fleet. Guys and girls that want to join, they're going to fly brand new equipment, which is really cool. It is state-of-the-art, the best. If you're going to go into combat, these are the airplanes you want to go into combat with. Marine aviation exists to support the grunts. That's the ethos of the Marine Corps. Marine aviation exists to support the ground scheme of maneuver, whether you're flying a fighter, a helicopter, or a transport. How do we help the ground scheme of maneuver, right? Air power doesn't win wars, broadly speaking. It's achieving that objective, and that is we got to take real estate. In order to do that, you need people on the ground, generally speaking.
Being a DPE is your like part-time job.
Oh, yeah. I did 22 years, right? So just to kind of go back a little bit, is I did the 10 years in the F-18. When I was teaching in the F-18 training squadron, they were finally starting to build the F-35. There was a selection board. Shocker, in the military, anything you want to do of prestige, there's a selection process, and people are going to talk about you and look at your records. It was very, very competitive. At the first board, I was not selected. I was alternate. I was like super bummed. But then 6 months later, they had another board that I was selected primary. And then the F-45 program delayed, so I kept teaching at the F-18 schoolhouse. Eventually, got orders to go down to Eglin. We showed up there, and we're like, where's the F-45? There were no jets. We sat around there, flew in the simulator, and eventually the jet showed up. So I did the F-45 for another 10 years. Finished up as the commander of the Marine Corps' F-45 training squadron. So think about like the equivalent of like a Part 141 school where you're teaching people how to fly. That was the squadron on the East Coast. We had 30 airplanes. We're training American Marine pilots how to fly the aircraft. We were training British pilots how to fly the aircraft and Italian pilots how to fly the aircraft. We even had British and Italian airplanes in our squadron. So it was very much a multinational thing. But all that said, it was focused on flying the aircraft and employing the aircraft as a good wingman. And then we'd send the kids out to their first operational units or pilots that came from other platforms that were learning how to fly the F-35. So maybe from the AV-8 or the F-18 or the A-6B, you're just teaching them how to fly this new airplane. I was going to retire. I had this great opportunity to come down here to Fort Worth to fly at Lockheed on the government side for a government agency called Defense Contract Management Agency, and then retired out of that job. Worked at Textron for almost a year.
Nice.
And that kind of ties into the DPE part. And then had this as like a job offer, couldn't refuse. They were hiring a civilian acceptance pilot to go fly the F-45.
Oh, that's how you got there.
So I had I remember talking to my wife, like, oh my God, what do I do? I have this amazing job at Textron. I loved what I was doing. I loved the management. We had a great mission there. I was the director of flight operations on the Mirage program, or is this a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go back and fly the F-45 as a civilian? I'm like, I got to do this. It's been great. I've been doing that for 4 years as a full-time job. And you know who you're working for. You're working for the warfighter. You know, getting the privilege to accept these aircraft on behalf of the contractor. and the government test them and then deliver them out to the warfighter has been amazing. You know, flying jets to Korea, flying them to Israel, flying them to operational base in the U.S., you know, it's really neat.
So how did you become a DP?
Right. So I'm a Textron, or ATAC, Airborne Tactical Advantage Company. So they have a campus up at Alliance Field. Several years ago, the Air Force, like, hey, we need more adversary support. They solicited industry, Textron and ATAC bid. In that background, they bought a lot of Mirage DAF-1. It's a fighter jet that the French built in the 60s, 70s, modified in the 80s and flew them through in like 2010, 2012. And then they had half-life on them, but they retired them. They didn't need it. Textron comes around and like, we'll buy all of them. They shipped them to the U.S., took the wings off, the tails off, the engines out. They assembled them up at Alliance Field. And at any rate, ATAC was hiring for a director of flight operations. I competed for the job. I got the job. And it's twofold. One is hire, recruit, train Mirage pilots. Then it was interact with the customer to get the airplanes and people out to the operating locations. We won three contracts, Eglin, Luke, and Holloman. And in 90 days, we had to send 12 or 15 airplanes out and like 20 pilots. And okay, we had like three flying airplanes and like four pilots. It was a mad scramble. How do you learn how to fly a Mirage? Well, it's not on contract yet, so everything we're doing is under Part 91, but it was a specialty aircraft, right? Because it's not a general aviation airplane, right? The way it's cataloged, it's a swept wing, high performance, supersonic aircraft, right? So we're training under basically FAA Part 61 and 91. So everything was based on executing and performing an ATP style check ride in a supersonic fighter. You know, we do academics for a week and you jump in, there's an instructor in your back seat, and you learn how to taxi the aircraft, take off and land, and do basic maneuvers. But in the ATP, there's no air combat maneuvering. You know, the FAA doesn't care about that. They care about you operating the aircraft safely. So they basically said, well, it's not a commercial private, like, let's just put it into an ATP. I do a couple rides, and next thing you know, this specialty aircraft examiner shows up. I had no idea what a DP was, what an ATP was. I didn't know and didn't really care at the time. I was just like, I just need to pass the check ride. And he's like, all right, here's your 8710. So we're going to fill that out. It looks at the logbook, you know, all the training, all the documentations, all the endorsements. I'd never had a civilian logbook until I got out. I had to like create
That's
one.
That's true, yeah.
And baseline all the hours. I had done my mil comp, right, for commercial aircraft, multi-engine land, single engine land and powered lift, and I've done mil comp for CFII. So I have these military equivalents, and DP shows up, we taxi, all the things that you have in your plan of action, took off, and we did clean and dirty stalls in the Mirage, which is kind of laughable. We did unusual attitudes, and then we did a precision, non-precision approach. We did malfunction simulated because it is a single engine. By the way, the DP's in the back seat. There is no hood in the aircraft because you're in the front seat, right? You got to fly the aircraft. So you're flying, referencing your instruments, and we're doing a non-precision approach. So take a guess how fast the Mirage goes in gear down configuration, no flaps on final.
140. 220. Oh my gosh.
So you're doing 210 to 220, no flap, and you're just screaming down final. There's not a lot of A-way forgiveness, right? Because you're not creating a lot of lift because your stubby little wings don't have the flaps down to kind of simulate a malfunction, right? And then you go and you do a precision approach and, you know, you have full capability. So there's about a 60 knot difference between no flap and full flap in the Mirage, you know?
Like, wow.
One is a true, no kidding, emergency. At any rate, gives me my temporary airman certificate as a authorized experimental in the DAA. AF1. I'm like, wow, it's really cool. A managing specialist, by and large, they have to sample a certain percentage or number of applicants that are reviewed or that are given a practical by a DP. My managing specialist, really any managing specialist, will do a sample, and oftentimes it could be via paperwork. They'll look at the quality of the paperwork, right? Because we do a bunch of entries to talk to the FAA, whether it's IACA or DMS, we'll get to that in a little bit. But there was only one authorized experimental. He had a temporary approval to do check rides in the Mirage. He was not even qualified in the aircraft at the time, but industry needed to make Mirage pilots.
Right.
So there are two companies out there, us and Draken. Now it's like, we need to train lots of pilots, like right now. I'm sitting at my desk and I get a call one day. It's like FAA. I'm like, oh man, what did I do? And someone introduced himself. He says, hey, I'm the managing specialist for this DPE or specialty aircraft examiner. So he's like, hey, how did the check ride go? I'm like, it's great. Got my temporary airman certificate. And he just has questions. He's like, did he brief you in a plan of action? Did he determine eligibility? Did he do the maneuvers that set forth? Like, just generic questions. I'm like, yeah, did all all those things. And he goes, do you have any questions? And I said, yeah, I don't even know what a DPE is or does. Like, this guy showed up. I feel like I'm more qualified to be a DPE or an examiner than he is. Like, I'm flying the aircraft. I'm an instructor pilot of the aircraft. I'm actually the PIC of the aircraft. And we're teaching people how to fly the aircraft. And he's like, well, that's actually an interesting question. 90 days later, I'm sitting in phase one training to become an examiner. I had no idea about any of the application process or DMS, or any of that stuff. We spend what should have been a 5-minute conversation turned into like 3 hours on the phone. And then I immediately pour myself into learning about the process of becoming an examiner. The end state behind that was not become a general aviation designated pilot examiner, is learning how to become an examiner only in the Mirage, which is a specialty aircraft examiner, so an SAE. And there's a long application process for anyone who wants to become a DPE, but you have to go through this big filter in order to be selected. Doesn't matter what kind of an examiner you want to be, but there's a standard. Some things get fast-tracked just because of need of industry and the fact that we had just a few, like one or two people that need to get this training done in order to fit industry, and we were more qualified in the aircraft. The experience at the FAA was amazing. Talk about a group of people who are underpaid and overwork. Absolutely incredible on that whole team. This is also in the middle of the pandemic, right? So phase one training, everything's on Teams, online, learning about the standards and reading PowerPoint slides. And then phase two training is now done in person at Oak City. All the new DPE class gets together and you sit there in academics for a couple weeks and they teach you how to become a DPE. At any rate, I'm sitting there in this Teams room. You go around the room, you got some 141 person there, you know, a chief instructor of another school, these people from all these backgrounds. There are no fighter pilots. And I'm like, I feel like the kid in the back of the class, you know, like not paying attention. I'm like, what did I get myself into? And they start talking about determining eligibility for the applicant and the aircraft, looking at endorsements, looking at airworthiness, looking at
all stuff that you were not familiar with.
I had no
at
idea.
All because you weren't civilian.
No idea what they were talking about. It's like, well, the applicant presents to you their long cross country from their, you know, point of departure to their first stop, straight line disc, and I'm like, all these things that now are like really, really important in general aviation. I'm like, how do I just audit this class? But you had to get through that, right? And it was very fascinating at the time, but I'm like, I just need to get through this training.
So it was 2 weeks of ground school?
It was the time, I think we did like a week of just you doing academics phase one. It was like looking at slide decks and taking an exam, if I remember it right. And then it was another week or two. It may have been 2 weeks. I can't quite remember. It was a few years ago. That was really how to become and exercise the privilege of being a designated pilot examiner. And again, like I said, you had people from every different background. We had some specialty aircraft examiners, you know, pilot examiners, commercial pilot examiners, people working for airlines. And so everyone's like trying to get a different authority from the FAA, but we have to go through this training. Imagine like you have gone through your private instrument commercial multi. The FAA is not just going to give you the keys to go and be like, yeah, here, have fun. Give this guy or girl a pilot certificate. So there's a very specific format. My interaction with an applicant is maybe 4 to 6 hours, and I'm only able to sample a little bit of what they know. In order for us to even start the exam, you have to determine eligibility. So you have to know how to parse out a logbook, right? And look at all of those very, very important endorsements and making sure all the hours are valid, right? Because you look in this ACRA application, you could put anything you want in terms of hours.
You could.
But you have to go back to the logbook. And then you have to determine eligibility right for the airplane, right? Because I'm going to put my pink fleshy body into that airplane and I want to make sure that it's safe. And then you have to go through the ACS for the appropriate certificate that the applicant's going for. How do you administer that evaluation? The oral and the practical. So a lot of time is spent on scenario development, on how you're going to approach that, right? Because what you don't want to do is just open up area of operation one, you know, section two, and look at airworthiness requirements. It's like, one knowledge, one risk, one skill. No, you want to weave that into a scenario because you have to have a reason to do the evaluation.
Right.
And then a lot of it also has to do with how to conduct the practical, right? If you just open up the ACS and you just go in order, you could sit there for 8 hours.
Oh, absolutely. You know, easy.
So a lot of it's mentorship on how to accomplish everything within the ACS in a reasonable amount of time. And you're sitting there with probably some of the most experienced DPE mentors, and they kind of mentor you through that process. And then you do a bunch of demo briefs where you are going to do role play with another DPE applicant. They're going to show you a sample logbook and you're going to have to find errors in there or make sure that they're eligible for that. So you get through that training and then there's a really, really hard test at the end. Really hard test. And did I mention it's a hard test? Again, I'm just trying to get through it for Mirage training, right? But everyone else is like, they're going to go out and do private pilot check rides. A couple weeks later, this FAA rep shows up at ATAC. We have to teach him how to fly the Mirage because he is going to conduct an evaluation for me to become an examiner. So I have to teach him how to fly the aircraft. So we spend a week, he's in the front seat, I'm in the back seat. We have a couple instructors. So we teach Chris how to fly the airplane. Great, great guy, former Air Force pilot. Finally, we have, it's examination day.
So you actually go in the aircraft for some training then?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
Check this out. You're going to be a new DPE. Let's say you're going to get a 172. So you get the applicant and you've got the, you know, soon to be DPE. And then you have the FAA rep in the back seat to conduct an observation.
Right.
Well, that's cool because you got a couple seats in the airplane. Well, the Mirage only has two seats. So it's going to be kind of a problem unless Chris is sitting on someone's lap. What we basically did is Chris observed me conducting the oral with an applicant who is, no kidding, going to be coming up for a check ride. I administered to Chris the oral as if he's going to go and fly. The whole time he's grading me on my ability to meet that PTS standard for the ATP and the oral discussion as it's focused on flying the Mirage, right? And then Chris jumps in the front seat, I'm in the back seat, and then I administer the practical to him, and then we land. Chris is like, you ready? He gives me my seal away to become an authorized examiner on the DAF1, and I give him a temporary airman certificate that he's authorized experimental F1.
Okay.
And then in the afternoon, I conduct an oral for the applicant. Chris is observing me now administer that. And then I go and fly with the applicant, and Chris is basically watching on 4Flight that we're doing the maneuvers, and he sits in the debrief. So it's kind of a weird way, very non-standard. But at any rate, we finish that, and then I do about 20 or 30 Mirage check rides the next year or two. At the end of the two-year period, kind of leading up to the GA part, Chris calls up. And he says, hey, you ever thought about doing general aviation? Now I'm flying the Mirage on the side. I'm flying the F-45 as the main job. I've got 8 hours in a 152 and from 1998. I'd never even thought about it. I'm like, GA, I don't know general aviation. He goes, no, man, you've been administering valuations on behalf of the FAA. You are a special aircraft examiner in good standing. You know how to determine eligibility. Like, it's just, it's eggs and bacon. Do you want it scrambled or do you want them over easy? And how do you want the bacon cooked? Just think about that in the context of another airplane and maybe a different ACS format. I was like, well, that kind of makes sense. He puts it that way. I said, well, how do we go about this? And he's like, well, you need to ask the request to expand your COA certificate letter of approval, giving the authority for an individual to conduct examinations on behalf of the administrator, the FAA.
Okay.
So I had to request to expand my COA just from doing the Mirage or specialty aircraft to becoming a PE and a CE. So to do private pilot examinations and commercial pilot examinations. I had 3,000 fighter hours, but 2,500 of them were dual given, right? Because I'm flying the F-18 in the back seat, or, you know, evaluating someone from a wing position or in the simulator, but literally thousands of hours instructing, right? So all that was there. You just got to kind of modify it into GA, but the concepts remain the same. So I went out to local flight school. I flew a bunch with their CFIs. It's kind of comical doing turns around a point. He's like, all right, we're going to do turns. He puts all this stuff up there. He's like, you know, we got to watch the winds. It's like, bro, are we just doing like going around that house? He's like, yeah, it's like really hard. I was like, uh-huh. Yeah, cool. We go out and do it. He's like, that's awesome. I'm like, how's that hard? He's like, well, imagine if you only got 15 hours flying. It's like really hard. I'm like, ah, good point. And we go through the rest of the maneuvers. Oh, he's like, are we going to do the power off 180? I'm like, all right. He's like, you know, you're just going to pull the power back. And you have to glide the aircraft and land on the runway. I'm like, uh-huh. Pulls the power back, do the glide, land the airplane. I'm like, I don't understand what's hard about this. Because imagine, don't have a lot of experience. Why? Because in the F-35, we do practice precautionary even flameouts from 10 or 15,000 feet at 230 knots. You know, it's bigger, faster, whatnot. But the concept remains the same. So I really quickly begin to appreciate what they're trying to impart on me. I have to take a step back from like, I have this experience. I'm like, no, dude, you are here to evaluate these kids, guys and girls that are going for these certificates. And this is like really important.
They're new.
They're new. So think about Adam back in the T-34. I'm like, oh yeah. So kind of taking a step back. At any rate, I fly in a Cessna and a Piper Warrior, and we go through all the maneuvers and then do some multi-engine rides on the Mighty Piper Apache at the time, conventional twin, a lot of fun there. And then I'm able to actually watch another DP administer check ride. You have to get special permission from their managing specialist in order to have someone else in the room. But I was like, oh, this is all kind of resonating. Determining eligibility, you know, going through the oral area of operations, doing the practical, the scenario, the plan of action. Okay, all that kind of resonates in being a special aircraft examiner. And then one day, a managing specialist comes down and observes me. We do a multi-engine check ride. We do a commercial check ride. And at the end of that day, he's like, all right, here's the updated COA. I was like, about a year and a half ago. Now I do private instrument commercial multi-check rides.
Okay, so the initial training then was about 2 to 3 weeks, including ground and flights.
The initial training is about 2 to 3 weeks ground, and then you have to get on their calendar for them to come down and conduct the observation.
How many flights is it?
We did one. I think we did a private and a commercial and multi. He just had a day or two, so he was able to watch several different.
Okay.
But to take a step back, right, I think it's important is that's not the normal way to become a pilot examiner, okay, right, when I went through. So I did take a couple notes, right? So for your folks out there that are interested in becoming an examiner, I would say the first thing you want to do, you want to go to your favorite browser and type in FAA and how to become a DPE. It will take you to the FAA website, and there is a bunch of great information on there on how to become a DPE, and it will drive you to Designee Management System, DMS. In there is how to contact a DPE if you need to schedule a check ride. That's all free. Or it takes you to the policy, and current policy is the 8095 Charlie, not to be confused with the Bravo.
Okay.
Charlie came out, I think, summer 23. Chapter 3 is how to become a designated pilot examiner, and it takes you through all the different paths. Do you want to become private, commercial, instrument, hot air balloon, gyrocopter, all these different flavors. So you got to look at the flow chart, and then basically it's like, hey, if you want to become a pilot examiner, so let's just say it's like 2,000 hours of total PIC, and maybe, I think, 500 hours of dual given, right? That's just the basic minimums. That could be off a little bit on the hours. And then there is a bunch of criteria you have to have met in terms of previous experience.
What are some examples of those?
Well, are you like, have you been the chief instructor of a 141 school? Are you the chief instructor of a 61 school? Have you trained pilots towards achieving a type rating? Different criteria like that is basically, have you held a leadership position in some kind of pilot training environment? So being your part-time CFI on the weekend is probably not going to meet that benchmark. Maybe if you're at one of the bigger flight schools and you've been grinding it out for several years, you know, basically running that entire school, you may meet that criteria, right? So look in chapter 3 and you'll see kind of all the requirements. I was able to leverage, well, I was a chief instructor as a squadron commander. I was also the training officer. You know, when I was teaching the F-18, I had 2,000 hours of dual given between those two platforms. They recognize that, right? It's like, well, you know, you're teaching people how to get a type certificate, i.e. an evaluation on the F-18 or F-35. If you're doing general aviation, the same concepts apply. So do you meet the basic eligibility? Then you create an account on DMS. Then you will apply, and then you need letters of recommendation. There's an interview panel, and probably the biggest thing, is there a need? Holly, is there a need for more examiners in the DFW area? Right?
Absolutely.
How long are people waiting to do an evaluation?
At some flight schools, they've been waiting 3 to 6 months for an evaluation.
It's terrible. Yeah. And so we're going to kind of jump between that thing you just mentioned from, is there a need? Well, I'm managed by AFG 970, which is like the national branch, but many DPs are managed by their local FISDA. There's work in the FA background to maybe make like a national office for all DPs, right? Because we're no longer geographically constrained. You can do evaluations anywhere in the United States.
That's helpful.
Yeah, I know it is. Yeah. I think right now, can't say this is 100% true, but there's probably a list of hundreds of applicants waiting to go through DPE training. So they have a pool of applicants ready to go. It doesn't mean you can't apply. You should apply if you meet the eligibility, but just human capacity. They got to look and screen all these applicants. Oh, by the way, before they even consider sending you to training or being like, yes, you got the thumbs up, you've got all this review and panel work that you need to kind of go through. The normal way is one day some managing specialist is going to call you up and be like, hey, I got your application front. They're going to do an interview with you. They're going to go through your resume, your background, and actually determine if there's any BS in that application, right? Well, maybe you were an instructor pilot like 20 years ago. You haven't flown an airplane outside of flying for an airline. You know, like you've been grinding doing something else for a long time. So let's just say you pass that, and then they're going to come down and they're going to fly with you. They're going to see, can you fly an airplane? Which obviously if you've done this application, you should, but they need to fly with you. So you've done the interview, you've done the board process, they've flown with you. Good. And then you got to wait for a school seat. Now, they can only take, let's just say, 20 or 30 applicants at a time. Maybe they do a class every couple months. So you can see how the backlog builds. The pandemic didn't help. They kind of stopped classes for a little bit. But I can tell you this. There is a team of people at Oak City and the entire Airman Certification Branch. They are working day and night to set the conditions, to train the backlog of DPs and get more people out there. But then you're also constrained by managing specialists. And there's a finite number of them. So in the FAA structure, I report to a managing specialist. He's got something like 20 or 30 different DPEs. I probably talk to him every week, email, text, phone. I had this issue, I got that, or I got a paperwork issue, he'll send it back. Imagine that, 20 or 30 people, and then he's got other things that he's got to do along with that. So it's human capacity to be able to process that. So they got to get in the school seat, and then they got to come back and they got to do the observations. I've met new DPEs, and I've asked them, how long did it take you? And I think from the time they created their login in DMS till the time they got their COA was probably a year or two. It depends.
Okay, yeah.
But if you're interested and you meet the eligibility in the 8,000.95, Charlie, please look at the requirements and apply. Nothing is stopping you from applying if you meet the eligibility and then get Gorilla's recommendation. And don't give up. Don't give up.
Are there any requirements or recurrent training you have to do as a DP?
You have to do recurrent training every 2 years. But every year you have to request to have your COA updated. So I just went through mine. And that's like, do you meet the annual requirements? So I think broadly speaking, it's have you flown 60 hours PIC in the last 12 months? And then have you flown, I think it's like 10 hours in each category and class. So I'm doing aircraft single engine land, aircraft multi-engine land. Well, you know, I fly the F-45, so that's aircraft single engine land. But for the multi-engine land, I have to go out there and maintain currency and proficiency. So rent an airplane, rent a twin, or you got to fly new twins. You need 5 hours PIC in order to conduct an evaluation in a GA twin. Learn how to fly Baron or twin Comanche last year. So it's 5 and 5, there's 10. Well, for the next year, I'm going to go and fly a couple more new different multis and make sure I maintain that. But that's for each category in class. If you had the hot air balloon thing on your COA, you got to go be a pilot in command of a hot air balloon, I guess, for a couple hours. It depends on what you got. And then every other year, you go through kind of refresher training. Last January, I went and we did it at the FAA office by DFW, and it was great. In a room with like 50 other DPEs, you get the smartest people, you know, from the FAA giving you the latest trends. And then there's always a test. So took another test, kind of refresher test, you know, kind of sample all the requirements that you have to know when you give an administer a check ride, and then you get that updated COA. So that's what you got to do.
Oh, aviation, the career of examinations.
That's right.
All right, guys. So that is the end of the first half of the DPE episode. I hope that you enjoyed it and found it beneficial for you. And maybe you even shared it with somebody else that you think would like it as well. Don't forget, sharing is caring. Please come back next week for the second half of the DPE episode. That will include the juiciest bits of the check ride itself. We'll mostly be talking about PPL check rides, but we'll also be talking about ways to prep for your check ride and things that you need to consider, even if you're a CFI, to prepare your student for that check ride. If you liked this episode, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review my podcast. And if you're watching this on YouTube, go ahead and hit that like button and subscribe to my podcast. It's free. And if there are any other guests you would like to see on my show, don't forget to comment on the video or just send me an email of something that you would like to learn about so we can keep you guys learning and becoming the best pilots that you can be. All right, guys, I'll meet you in the sky. See you later, aviators. We'll